This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes. Also, make sure to check out and subscribe to our YouTube original channel, UCTV Prime, available only on YouTube at youtube.com/UCTV Prime. This UCTV podcast is sponsored in part by Audible.com, your destination for the widest selection of digital audiobooks available, including many by guests you've heard here on UCTV. Audible.com is offering UCTV podcast listeners a free 30-day trial subscription and one free audiobook download. Just visit audibletrial.com/UCTV to sign up. That's audibletrial.com/UCTV. And thanks.
Greetings, everybody. Well, what a pleasure it is to be here with presenting such a distinguished panel and talking about Egypt, of course, which is the main game in the Arab Middle Spring, to respond to champions of Tunisia this morning. Egypt, 80 million people, so important. It's so critical that it goes through this democratic transition, and yet much of what could go wrong has gone wrong. And there's a very real possibility as it goes through this transition that we may not end up with the kind of democratic, pluralistic, constitutional government that was held up as a great big promise almost 18 months ago. Interestingly, if one compares Egypt to Tunisia, Libya even, Egypt, along with both of those countries, committed itself to a transitional period, a constitutional declaration, and a sequence of elections, constitution-making process, and a return to constitutional government. But in the Egyptian case, unlike Tunisia and Libya, things have not quite turned out the way they should have. Nobody has designed Egypt's transition sequence per se, and it's turned out to be almost one damn drama after another. The current president was the second choice of a movement that had originally planned not to run a candidate. The elections themselves were held before a new constitution was adopted, and we have a dissolved parliament right now with a president who's ruling almost by decree, and with a new parliament that might not be elected until sometime next year. Nonetheless, Egypt's politics continues, and there is still some hope that it will go through that with a good result. But with that context, I'd now like to introduce Shibli Talami. I'll introduce each speaker respectively. They'll have approximately 12 to 15 minutes to address different aspects of Egypt's transition. Thereafter, I'll throw it over to questions to the floor. And our first speaker today is Shibli Talami, the Anwar Sadat Peace and Development Chair from Maryland University. She's published widely on the region and U.S. foreign policy. And welcome, Shibli.
Thank you.
Thanks. It's great to be back at Berkeley. I always feel like I'm back home. Unlike Eva, I think I've lived here more almost than any other place. So it's really wonderful to be back. I'd like to make six general points about what we're witnessing, particularly in Egypt, and also relate a little bit broadly to the rest of the region. I'm going to start with a point that someone asked about earlier, which is the observation that Arab analysts didn't predict the Arab uprisings. And actually, it's not entirely true. Frankly, it's not entirely true. In fact, it's not true at all. Actually, most people have been predicting some eruption. Obviously, the timing they didn't. Timing matters. In dating back to the 1990s, 1997, the only op-ed article I've ever published that's a cartoon form. I actually pretended to be an artist read it in the LA Times, was about why the Middle East could explode any time. And I said that essentially the bottom line was, don't learn from the fact that it didn't do yesterday and the day before that it's not going to happen tomorrow. That was the gist of my argument. And in the 2002 book, The Stakes, that I wrote, I had a chapter called Does Arab Public Opinion Matter? I went against the norm of those who were suggesting authoritarianism mean public opinion is irrelevant. And I did say that revolutions are possible, even if fair, in that book as well. And that's based on my study of public opinion over the past two decades, including over a decade of Arab public opinion polling that preceded, by the way, Gallup. We've been doing it for longer a period and focused more on the Arab world than the Islamic countries, which is what they tend to do. So no, it's not true that people, this came as a surprise. But there was a surprise, and let me tell you what the surprise was. The surprise is a little bit different, and I think it relates in some ways, I want to relate it to what's happening in Egypt since, which is, I think we all knew that the Arab publics were angry with the rulers, and that the gap between publics and rulers was expanding by the day. So there was never really even a question about, will Arabs ever have a reason to revolt? The question was, why haven't they revolted already? And we had an answer for that as political scientists, and that answer was that it's not enough to have a lot of angry people to mobilize, hundreds of thousands to the streets in a manner that would create change. And in order to do that, you needed political organizations, social organizations, charismatic leaders to be able to, be essentially the link between the anger and political action. I mean, that's the bottom line. And so you looked around and said, well, there aren't many. And, these rulers understood the two. They chopped heads. They arrested. They watched. It wasn't going to happen. If there was a surprise, again, not entirely a surprise, I'll explain why, was that when you look at what happened in Tunisia and what happened in Egypt, there were revolutions that didn't, in the first place, require organizations. They were basically, people were able to actually act on massive scale that counted without the need to rely on political organizations and parties and charismatic leadership. And obviously, the information revolution was the enabler of this mobilization without the need for political parties. And so that was a shock in the sense that how effective and rapid it happened was surprising, but it wasn't surprising even for the decade for the scholars, because dating back to the late 1990s with the emergence of the Jazeera, most of us started studying, understanding that the information revolution is going to have a revolutionary impact on politics that we needed to study empirically. And so when we put in place the public opinion polling dating back to the 1990s with the Carnegie Corporation of New York funding a project for a whole decade, it was about, let's look at how this information revolution is changing public opinion and the ability of public to, the empowerment of the public over time, because we need to understand it. We don't have enough about it. So it's not really true that we were operating in a vacuum. I think we shouldn't beat ourselves to death on this. I think the fact is revolutions are hard to predict in general. They don't happen very often. Name how many revolutions you can name even globally over. We still talk about the French Revolution, as something that's a model. And yet, I want to use that to conclude. I think that despite the importance of the information revolution mobilizing the public to revolt, some people may have sort of concluded that political parties and organizations are less relevant. Well, if you look at the Egyptian environment and the early elections in Egypt, one thing that is absolutely clear is that political parties and organizations remain central to the outcome of electoral politics in post-revolutions. And let me just give you one example of that we should keep in mind. And that is that look at the first round of the Egyptian presidential elections. We had about a dozen candidates running. You had an environment where if you looked at the public opinion polls just 3 weeks prior to the elections, the two leading candidates, according to all public opinion polls that were conducted, both by Egyptians and outside, by outsiders, were Amr Moussa, the former Secretary General of the Arab League, and Abdelmoneb Abdel Fattouh, the moderate Islamist, both of whom were independent with no real political parties behind them. When push came to shove, the two candidates that won that initial round, the first and second candidate, were the only two candidates that had political parties behind them. The Muslim Brotherhood candidate and the candidate who was backed by the National Democratic Party, the former Mubarak Party and the elites around the regime, Ahmed Shafiq. And so parties in the end mattered a lot for mobilizing. And the interesting thing is when you look at the actual outcome of that election, only 46% of the Egyptians voted in that round. And think about that. This is like the empowerment of the public. This is the first major meaningful presidential election in the history of Egypt ever. You get 46%. That tells you also about the turnout and why organizations matter. And if you look even in that election, when you look at the two candidates who won the most vote and had to have a runoff, Shafiq and Morsi, together they only gained less than 50% combined of the 46% who voted in that election. So just keep that in mind. Again, a reminder of how central. You know, maybe the organization not as important for mobilizing revolts, but they sure are still extremely central in the conduct of democratic politics, and we've seen that very much in the Egyptian case. Second, there was, you know, over the past couple of days, we had heard sort of what are the Arab notions of democracy, you know. So how do Egyptians perceive democracy? What do they think of? What image do they have when they say we want democracy? Of course, you know, people cited polls who say, oh yeah, we were for democracy. Well, that's not meaningful enough. I mean, so, you know, everybody's for democracy, everybody for equality. The question is, you know, how they interpret it, what it means in practice to them. That's really what matters. And so we've been polling on this for a whole decade in Egypt and elsewhere. And one of the questions I ask in these polls is that name the two countries that are most democratic and have most freedom for the people. And I don't give them any names at all. I just have it an open question. And we've been doing it year after year. And every single year, all the top answers are Western European countries and the United States of America. Without exception. France usually is number one. It has been number one. It's another story why France is number one. But certainly that's true in Egypt, overwhelmingly. And when you ask, I mean, in secondary questions, I give them a mix of countries, including Western Europeans, China, Russia. And as an Islamic country, I gave Pakistan because this was about power, not really so much about democracy. But I asked them, where would you want to live if you had to live in one of these countries? Of course, nobody wanted to live in Pakistan. And of course, nobody wanted to live in China. And of course, nobody imagined studying in Pakistan and China. And all of the choices were, you know, the United States or France or the UK. So what they know, you know, maybe they don't know exactly what democracy is because they haven't lived it. But they know it when they see it. And so as to think that they kind of have a vision of democracy that is outlandish or some unique form in their mind, that's not true. I mean, they know what democracy, they know that. These European countries that they're naming are more democratic than any countries in the Arab world, or for that matter, Muslim world. They don't name Indonesia or even Turkey in that mix. Now, that doesn't mean that's what they want. So, again, they have a notion of what is democracy, but will they choose that democracy for themselves? That's the real question. And so, we have been asking in Egypt and in other places in the Arab world, Basically, if you want your country to look like another country, which one would you want it to look like? Which political system would you want your country to look like? And by far, the number one answer is Turkey. By far, the number one answer is Turkey. That's true in Egypt. That's true in other Arab countries. And it's true also, by the way, I have another question, which is, name the leader that you want Egypt's president to look most like in prior to the election. I did one on the, just prior to the Egyptian election in May. The prime minister of Turkey is by far number one. Okay, so Turkey is the model that they envision. They don't think Turkey is the most democratic country in the world, but they think it is the country that brings the mix of identity, religion, and democracy that they want. And that's really important to keep in mind, that this is, you know, they have a ranking in their head about what democracy looks like, but they want democracy, but they don't only want democracy. I mean, that's a thing that we have to keep in mind. By the way, Turkey, interestingly, it's very important to see when it captured Arabs' imagination. The prime minister of Turkey, now we take for granted, you know, when we look retrospectively, we say, well, Turkey is capturing the imagination because it's an Islamic democracy. Absolutely not true. Erdogan didn't show up. When I asked the question, whom do you admire among world leaders, he didn't show up in 2003. He didn't show up in 2004. He didn't show up in 2005. He didn't show up in 2006. He didn't show up in 2007. He was overtaken by leaders like Hassan Nasrallah of Hezbollah and Jacques Chirac of France. And he only showed up in 2008. And guess why he showed up in 2008? Because of the Gaza war and his stand on the Gaza war. It is partly an identity question and partly a democratic question. It's that combination that makes Turkey attractive. Turkey started capturing the imagination when it refused to allow American forces on its soil to attack Iraq in 2003. And from there, you know, it began rising. But it's this mix of the two that come together. That's what people want. What sort of role do they want for religion in politics specifically? Because that's one of the questions that we have. Well, in part, the Turkey answer provides you know, an answer to this question as well. And actually, specifically, we did ask a question: which of the following countries provide the kind of relationship between religion and politics that you want most for Egypt? So we actually asked this question. Then I provided Muslim countries that could possibly be examples, and that included you know, Malaysia, Morocco, Tunisia, Saudi Arabia, Turkey, Indonesia, and Iran. And again, to that question, the number one answer is by far Turkey. Iran certainly isn't up there in that mix. A lot of other reasons why that's true. So we have that answer. When you ask Egyptians, do you want the clergy to play a bigger role or a lesser role in politics prior to the revolution? They were divided, but more people, a plurality, said actually they want the clergy to play a bigger role, not a lesser role in their politics. In the May 2012 poll, just before the presidential election, we asked a question about the role of Sharia specifically in politics. Now recall that almost all polls, including the Gallup poll and the Pew poll, show that Egyptians are actually identify themselves to be the most religious in the world. When you ask them about their religion in daily life, Egyptians rank highest of all the over 100 and some countries measured across the world. Egyptians identify themselves as most religious of all countries. When you ask people specifically about what role they want Sharia to play in their political system, you get interesting answers. First, 66%, two-thirds of Egyptians want Sharia to be the basis of law. Now, this might seem as entirely shocking, and I'm going to come back to that. A follow-up question, among those who said they want Sharia to be the basis of law in Egypt, was, do you envision Sharia to be interpreted literally, including to penal code, or do you envision implementing the spirit of Sharia adapted to modern times? We gave them those two choices. 80% of Egyptians chose the latter. 80% of those who had said yes, they want Sharia to be the basis of law. So yes, they want Sharia to be the basis of law. It has been in Egypt anyway. But their interpretation of Sharia, they don't want the literal interpretation of Sharia. And that's very clear. And I have to say that I just finished a book called The World Through Arab Eyes, and I have a chapter on identity. And it's interesting because I think we always miss what people mean when they say, I'm a Muslim, or yes, I embrace Sharia. I mean, it's hard to be a Muslim and not embrace Sharia. And for me, when I hear it, I see it as an asserted, as most of the time, for most people, not all people, as essentially an assertion of identity, as particularly when that identity is under assault or seen to be under assault from the outside, where people are saying, I don't have to apologize for the fact that I'm a Muslim. I am a Muslim. I don't have to apologize for the fact that Sharia is important in Islam. It is important in Islam. And I think we make too much of it most of the time. Now, that doesn't mean that there aren't people, and I think this is perhaps a significant minority, particularly in Egypt, we have indications that possibly, you know, a quarter who actually envision a much more literal interpretation of Sharia. But it's certainly, we have to be very careful in how we interpret these results. Let me make just two more points. One about the role of women, particularly, and minorities, and one about the outside role in democracy. We know that I think if you ask me, what are you fearful most for in the short term, in the democratic experiments in the Arab world with the rise of Islamist groups, I would say the role of women. I am worried about it personally. Now, I know in Tunisia it's been relatively good, and in Egypt is not as good, and we could talk about that a little bit in terms of how women feel about the assault. But I don't think the issue is theological. I mean, that is, when you ask people about how they interpret, the role of women, you can have multiple answers. And obviously, you look at the Arab world and the Muslim countries, and there's so many variations of how people interpret the role of women and the rights of women. And I am of the opinion that there are two things that are going to be central. One thing is the Constitution. I think the constitutional issues will be ultimately central for what happens with women's rights and minority rights, particularly in Egypt. And I say constitutions matter because, look, I mean, if you want to just drive the point home about how central constitutions are, think about what happened after the revolution in Egypt. Here you have a popular revolution overthrowing a regime that had put in place a constitution that is essentially rejected by the public in theory and really in belief. And that constitution still had implications even for the elections. So they threw out the Salafi candidate. They threw out the first candidate in the Muslim Brotherhood. And those were the two parties that won the majorities in the parliament. And they swallowed hard and accepted it because these were still important, and it's very hard to avoid it, even a revolutionary time. Just keep that in mind, because ultimately I think the battle of the Constitution will be the biggest battle of all, for sure. But the second is something that Steve Fish talked about yesterday, which is the political economy. And I'm of the opinion, when I'm looking at what is happening in the Arab world, I see the information revolution as the empowering element that is increasing the voice of the public, and that's going forward, it's not going backward. I mean, you know, and that's true for women as well, because it equalizes a little bit, and it does empower women a little bit more. But in the end, if you look at all the transitions in other countries, empowerment of women over time, it is almost always tied to the political economy of women and earning wages. I mean, if women earn wages, that's when power starts. And if you don't transform that, maybe the oil economy is a problem. There's Michael Ross of UCLA who has this fascinating article arguing that, in fact, it was the political economy of oil that has not created enough opportunities for women in oil-producing countries and oil economies, even outside of oil-producing countries, like remittances of workers coming to in Egypt, for example, that has prevented the empowerment of women. And I'm of that opinion as well. I think in the end, that's an area to watch for. And that is supported by the polls. And let me tell you a question that I ask in the polls about women in Egypt and what answers we get. The one question we've been asking over a decade is, do you believe that women should have the right to work outside the house? Always, never, or only when economically needed. So what do we get? We get less than 20% say never. We get roughly a third saying always. And a plurality, and sometimes a majority, say only when economically needed. Because these norms are flexible depending on the economic needs. And I think that economic aspect is going to remain the principal driver, besides the Constitution, of whether or not you have an expansion of women's rights. In the short term, it's troubling because the norms of the parties that are going to win and the traditions and the culture is going against it, and I worry about it in the short term, but in the long term, those are the driver. Final point, having to do with particularly the American rule. The Arab Revolution's democratic reform. And I think it's interesting because you have all those people from the Bush administration now say, you see, we told you so. You know, we started it all. We preached democracy, and the Arabs have finally responded and empowered. And the Obama administration, you know, basically put it on the back shelf the first 2 years, and then they got stuck with it, and now they have to deal with it. So it's all because of America's advocacy of democracy. Well, it's interesting because we have, in fact, been falling on this for the whole decade, since before the Iraq War. The first poll I did on this was just before the Iraq War in early 2003, and then we pulled on it every single year. Let me tell you what the polls show about American advocacy of democracy. Number one is that Arabs never believed America is pushing for democracy. Every single year, we ask, how important do you think democracy is in America's foreign policy toward the Middle East? Less than 10% of people said it's important, and overwhelmingly said this is essentially a rationalization for America's attempt to dominate oil or help Israel. So there was never an acceptance at the public level that the Bush administration was actually pushing for. More importantly, every single year after the Iraq War, we ask, is there more democracy or less democracy in the Middle East than the year before? Every single year, they said there's less democracy than the year before. And number three, in reality, despite all the rhetoric, actually the Middle East did become more repressive over the past decade. And in large part, because of what we were doing. And that is because essentially you had 90% of the Arab public say, we are opposed to the Iraq War. And you had an administration which went against public opinion and then went to governments, Arab governments, and asked them for support for the Iraq War that 90% of the public supposed. And in order to do that, what did they do? They basically had to repress more. They had to rely on the same institutions of repression, the military and security services, and the U.S. in its need to get the support of the military and security services in the war on terrorism, the war in Iraq and Afghanistan, essentially helped bankroll more of those same institutions that were far more repressive over the decade. And so the public perception within, including including in Egypt, was that there was less democracy, not more democracies throughout. If there was an impact of the past decade, it was actually for different reasons. And that is that when you look at Turkey, for example, the fact that Turkey, despite being a member of NATO, found itself rejecting the request to allow to support the Iraq war while Arab rulers essentially were allowing the U.S. to operate from their soil, contrasted their authoritarianism with democracy in Turkey. The fact is that if you look at the anger with governments over the past decade, I would say it was far more related to foreign policy over the past decade than it was related to more repression per se. Because while there was slightly more repression, it was not a particularly unique episode in the history of the Arab world. But the Arabs faced three episodes of war that were humiliating to them. The Iraq War, the Lebanon War, the Gaza War, where the governments were on the wrong side and they could do nothing about it. And so in that sense, I think the net result was certainly fueling far more anger and humiliation in the Arab world and a bigger gap between publics and governments in the Arab world, but certainly not because America advocated democracy. Thanks very much.
Very good. Thanks very much, Sidney. Thank you. Well, ladies and gentlemen, if I could now introduce Robert Bob Springborg. Bob is a professor of national security affairs at the School of International Graduate Studies in Monterey. He's a proud Australian citizen and has a much rewarded commentator and published widely on many aspects of the Middle East and North Africa. Thanks very much, Bob.
Thank you, Peter. Great pleasure to cross the bridge to be in sunny Berkeley and come back to an old stomping ground, which I don't get to enough. I hate to start by having to defend my Democratic credentials, but I do. I was a member of Americans Elect, so those who follow that will know that should entitle me to something. But many of my Egyptian friends called my commitment to democracy into question during and after the dramatic events of last year. And they did so because I, as those events unfolded, I became aware, both through firsthand knowledge as well as sort of an assessment of the situation, that there was a plan, and that the plan was by the military to essentially abort the process and to engineer a transition which they would control. And so when I wrote to that effect, then I was accused of sort of supporting that. Indeed, I wasn't supporting. I was trying to make it clear that there was such a plan, and beware, friends. But it wasn't sort of interpreted that way. And then I also made the mistake of publishing a piece in Survival that focused on the seven demographic democratic deficits, which was a sort of an attempt, as Steve Fish was talking about, Seymour Martin Lipset was the founding member of the School of Structural Impediments to Democratization. And so I tried to run with this a little bit with recent research. And if you looked at seven indicators, correlations of democracy that are around in the literature, you found that Egypt scored very poorly on all of them. And so again, it looks like I was arguing against the possibility and indeed the preference for democracy. But let me hasten to add, that was not the case. I believe that democracy is absolutely vital to the transition that is underway from the post-colonial state to the post-post-colonial state. Now, we know what post-colonial states were like. They, in the good Hegelian thesis and antithesis, ended up as being as authoritarian as the predecessors. So what's the antithesis going to be like now with the post-post-colonial state? And here's where democracy comes in. There are at least four challenges to this transition, and I think democracy would facilitate these transitions better than any other form of government. Now, what are they? First, It's to keep these states together. There is a threat to the very existence of these nation states. Libya, possibly. Iraq, certainly possibly. Sudan has already come apart. Syria, where is that headed? Even the fissiparous tendencies in Egypt are notable at the present time. Whether the Sinai, our long quiescent Nubians have demonstrated some nationalist tendencies and so on. So keeping the states together, and I think democracy, because these states were kept together by very authoritarian regimes, now there's going to need to be new glue. Democratic negotiation of those states, it seems to me, is the best glue that could possibly be provided. Secondly, economic development, a major challenge. The book that Clem Henry and I did found that in the Middle East and North Africa, there was a direct correlation between political liberalism and economic growth. And I would argue that that is true not only of the region, but more generally. And so if these economies are going to develop, they are going to have an underpinning of greater freedom of a political nature and hopefully democratization. Third, and it may seem almost tautological, but one needs to pluralize these political systems in the contestation between the number of members and the arenas within which they are contesting to avoid what was the post-colonial state of government of an opposition, of an authoritarian state and a fragmented and disempowered opposition. It is possible that in our post-colonial states, we can recreate this with Islamists on the one hand and secularists on the other. And so democratization, providing more arenas for that contestation, is likely to at least diversify the competition and hopefully then the outcomes from it. And then finally, civilian control of armed forces. I could have put it at the top, but this is the focus basically of the rest of my talk. Unless the deep states or shadow states, and these are two terms those of us who are out of history studying the Middle East have contributed, it seems to me, to broader literature. The deep state and the shadow state, first was Turkey, second Iraq with Charles Tripp. And why did Middle Eastern studies generate this pernicious and indeed threatening idea? Because it's so true. Because the deep state of the military and the security services, which we have seen in their different combinations from Tunisia to Syria and so on, are absolutely vital. So to bring these deep states, to surface them, to bring them up, and to bring them under institutional control by civilians is absolutely vital. So, first now then, what is this pattern of control of armed forces that we have had? And I began to speculate on this as we now are opening up new possibilities. And as they were being opened, I was approached by Transparency International to do their Egypt chapter in the new series that they're doing, basically on civilian control of military institutions, to add to their General Transparency Anti-Corruption Index. And so I began on that process. There are some 44 countries and about 40 indicators, 0 to 5. From the least controlled to the most controlled by civilians. And what I found in looking at Egypt is I could only find 2 of these 40-plus indicators where they could get above 0, and they could only get the 1. And so clearly the measures that Transparency International was using were not applicable either in Egypt or in other Arab countries. And then we began a project for a defense atlas for Arab countries based on a similar undertaking in Latin America, the Defense Atlas, which is a Encyclopedia of Civil-Military Relations. So pulling the concepts from this work done by NGOs in Latin America, we are trying to replicate essentially the same thing, and have found, indeed, we can't work with the concepts for civilian control because they are operable nowhere in the Arab world. And so the question is, why is the Arab world so unique, and how do civil-military relations work there? I don't have time, clearly, to go into the various answers. There are structural ones, the role of hydro, and many of them have been mentioned here, by the way, because they are also the factors that impede democratization more generally. Hydrocarbon wealth, Islamism, the presence of it, external actors, ourselves included, of course, the hotly contested security environment of the Middle East. And then we have this funny state phenomenon, which hasn't been mentioned much. But the Arab states are funny states. They're 8 monarchies. What other region of the world has 8 monarchies? And then if we take a look at the republics, Clem Henry and I, Clem being a former professor here at Berkeley too, we cut them into 2 different types of Praetorian states, bully states, and bunker states. And Cambridge University Press didn't like this rather glib term, but believe you me, it reflects reality. As we see now, as from Gaddafi to Bashar al-Assad, they retreated to their bunkers. And the bullies didn't have bunkers to retreat to, Ben Ali and Mubarak. So I think we called it pretty well. So they're funny states. They're rather unique in the world. So these contextual factors then shape civ-mil relations. The core of the matter is that the control of militaries, to the extent they are controlled rather than they control themselves, is sultanistic means. And I know that Middle Eastern scholars don't like to use the word sultanism because it seems to imply Orientalism, but believe you me, Max Weber had something there, and it's worthwhile digging into that. And I won't go into the various methods of sultanistic control because this panel is supposed to be on Egypt, but this was all sort of setting the stage for what's going on in Egypt today. And let me now speculate absolutely off the top of my head about that. Some months ago, it became clear that the main contest was between the SCAF, which was leading in the name of the military, although as it turns out, there was plenty of opposition in the military to the SCAF, and the brothers. And so I likened them to the Cobra and the Mongoose, the Mongoose being the brothers, because I thought the brothers would get the upper hand against them, but not so quickly. I confess that I didn't see that the coup was coming, the coup within the coup, in the wake of the breakdown of control in the Sinai and the ability then of Morsi to be able to first get control of Cairo through the head of general intelligence, through directorate for Cairo, through the command of the central force, not the central security force, but central military force in Cairo, and then to go after Tantawi. So he laid his grounds extremely well indeed. So, having purged Tantawi and the rest of the leadership of the SCAF, the question is, what's next? How is this going to play itself out? And what will the future of civ-mil relations be like in Egypt? Well, one possibility is a partition. A new partition. There was a partition before between Mubarak on the one hand and the military on the other, and between Sadat and the military and so on. So you simply draw a new line. You have a separate military empire, and then you have a presidential empire. Presumably, the line would move a little bit to favor the civilian one in this case, but a new partition plan. Second is you have democratic institutional control. As Shipley was talking about, a constitution being hotly contested now, and it will give rise, presumably, to elections and parliament and so on. Maybe this will all work out, and the combination of the institutions of the state and civil society, and especially the media, will control the military. And then lastly, and most worrying in some ways, is a backward step, which is that the military becomes not the sword of the nation, which is the term that the officers themselves like to use, but it becomes the sword of Islam. And so that the military is controlled, and better yet, the more appropriate term is used by the brothers as their instrument. And this is akin then, of course, to the old Soviet model of party control in the Middle East, the closest it ever came was Saddam, or the Iranian model, the IR, the Republican Guard, the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps. So those are your three options. Where are we? Well, if we take a look at the appointments that have gone on that Morsi has been able to control, it would suggest the desire on the part of the brothers to really get control of the state apparatus, of the civilian side. And we know who these people are, and we can see that one after another in the key positions, either fellow travelers or actual members of the Brotherhood are being appointed. What about in the military? Who is General Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, who is now the Minister of Defense, and his deputy, Sidki Sopi? Sidki Sopi, you have probably seen some of the things that he has said, because they were widely quoted in the American media, being taken out of his thesis from our National War College. I doubt if any of you have seen the equivalent from General Assisi, who was also there, who did not write a thesis, but who wrote some papers. And I've had the privilege of looking at those papers, and I can assure you that General Assisi is a very religious man, that his musings on democracy and the future of his country are almost straight out of the musings of members of the Brotherhood. So we have a man here who is clearly a fellow traveler. I'm not suggesting he's a member of the Brothers. In fact, I've said repeatedly in the media he's not. He could not be an active member of the Brothers, given the way the military has been partitioned off and the very living situations of the military and their inability to interact freely with Brothers. But in terms of his beliefs and those officers on our side who've interacted, he is a deeply religious figure who approaches democracy, and I'm not at liberty, unfortunately, to give you these papers, but who approaches democracy very much within a classic sort of a Brotherhood framework, that it is the implementation of classical Islam, the Khalafa, the Shura, Baya, all of it is there. So I think we now have a gentleman who is now retired, 200 officers who are above him, and is replacing them, who is likely to look for fellow travelers. So I think we're moving some way down the track here for the sort of the army as the sword of Islam. So what are the factors working against this? I don't think that outcome will occur, by the way. I think there will be an attempt to do it. I think it'll be pushed back. First, the Brotherhood is not going to have it all its own way. It has competitors. It has civil society actors. It sort of has ourselves, although our policy is very fragmented. To the extent we have a policy, since our president is on the campaign trail, he's not in the kitchen. He's not cooking up a policy with regard to anything right now. So at this vital time, we really don't have a government. Those of you who go back and forth to Washington, whether in the DOD or state or you name it, you'll find nobody's there. It's a government not at home. So we're not really responding except to sort of kick the can down the road a little bit here. But as push comes to shove, we might respond. So there are a couple of actors that will push back against the Brotherhood. The military itself, I suspect, is the most vital actor here. And just because the Minister of Defense may have certain preferences and inclinations, there are plenty of folks in the military who will not share them. And so the vulnerability is precisely the vulnerability that Tantawi and company had, that there were those in the military who did not like the fact that their institution was being used and abused by Mubarak's henchmen. So I think the military has the potential to push back. Why would it push back? It's the economy, stupid. There is a huge economic problem in Egypt, and I'm sure Mahmoud is going to address that, and this is the transition. That Morsi's trying to handle the economy not by handling the economy. He's trying to handle the economy by playing foreign affairs. That's the basic strategy, to legitimate the rule and to gain resources through an activist foreign policy, much as Nasser did before him. And I would humbly submit that just as Nasser overplayed his hand, and just as Erdogan has overplayed his hand, and just as Ahmadinejad has overplayed his hand, and you can just add the list forever here, that Morsi will overplay his hand. And then the problem of the underperforming economy sucks away the legitimacy of the state, and that provides the opportunity for opposition, whether military or civilian, and possibly both. So in some then, the history of civil-military relations in the Middle East is a complex one. It's a vital subject. It's been understudied. And we're going into a new chapter here with the post-colonial states, and no one's quite sure where it's headed, but it's sort of fun to muse upon.
Wonderful, Bob. Thank you very much. Ladies and gentlemen, Mahmoud El-Gamal, who will talk to Islam and economics in Egypt from Rice University, and he's also served with the IMF as well. Thanks very much, Mahmoud.
Thank you very much for inviting me. I'd like to add a new dimension to the discussion so far. So instead of thinking only about a one-dimensional political model where you have theocratic regimes on the one end and secular regimes on the other, and think that there's the religious right and the left is always liberal or secular, that there is such a thing as leftist Islamist. And I submit to you, this is my thesis, that that's actually the majority coalition in Egypt that's not represented by any political group or party. The U.S. administration, when it's there, and the international community have sort of decided that they're going to live with an Islamist regime. But, of course, that's only when the Muslim Brotherhood came to Washington and it sounded like their economic plan was exactly the National Democratic Party's plan. That they could live with. So let me start. So the Washington Consensus people thought both Tunisia and Egypt were from. I'm an economist. I run in economic circles, and everybody was surprised. You know, why are Arabs complaining so much? You compare them to Latin America, Asia, and so on. They're doing great, especially Tunisia and Egypt. And they were the poster children for high growth because of the liberalization policies that they were undertaking. These were going to be the successful cases, and. Better yet, these were secularist regimes, oppressive but secularist, that were implementing these economic reforms and producing these good results, so everything looked really good. But of course, my claim is going to be that most of the population was diametrically at the opposite end of this. They were both anti-secular and leftist. So you're having right-wing neoliberal agendas being pushed down the country's throat by secularists, when the people are the exact opposite. So the evidence I'm going to show you, I'll show you the actual data pictures. This is a Steve Fish kind of thing, you know. I'm not going to massage the data. I'm a good enough statistician. I can prove anything, and it's opposite with any data set. So I'm not going to massage the data, but I'm going to selectively show you a few things. So for a measure of leftism, I'm going to use a question, and I'll use the World Value Survey. Again, I'm as an economist, this is the first time in my career that economists have been suffering political science envy. So I had to look around to figure out, and I was told the World Value Survey was sort of the gold standard. So I went there, and I found some interesting questions. So two questions I'm going to use for measures of leftism. One is redistribution. That is an essential element of democracy, that a government should tax the rich and subsidize the poor. Now, of course, neoliberalism is all about removing subsidies, so that doesn't work. And another one, and it goes all the way from this is not at all essential to democracy to this is essential to democracy. So what do they understand democracy to be? And another question was whether you need more private ownership of corporations or more government public ownership. And that's the spectrum. Again, if you want more government control, you're on the left. If you want more private control, you're on the right. And so you think of the neoliberal agenda that was working in Tunisia and Egypt, producing 8% growth rates, and it was privatization and removal of subsidies to the extent that it was possible. Okay, so for the anti-secularism measure, I'm going to use only one question here, which is, again, a spectrum. Is it essential for a democracy that religious authorities should interpret the law? Right? So either not at all essential, up to essential, scale of 1 to 10. Okay, so the Muslim Brotherhood people in Washington, everybody keeps talking about Turkey and Malaysia as, well, sort of successful, somewhat Islamist regimes, and so why shouldn't Egypt get something like this? I will show you the comparisons. Egypt looks nothing like Turkey, nothing like Malaysia on these dimensions. So the Muslim Brotherhood is going to deliver, or so far is delivering, anti-secularism. There's no question about that. But with the new Washington consensus on economics, it's been watered down a little bit. This is neoliberalism with safety nets, but social safety nets. But it's neoliberalism. You know, it's privatization, remove the subsidies. That's the conditionality for the IMF $4.8 billion loan, etc. Right? That's the road forward. So, and that's why they got the green light. But I don't think that's going to work, because that's still not where the majority of the population really is. Okay, so how am I going to show this? Just a bunch of graphs. I'll go through them quickly. So the argument is Egypt is much more leftist and anti-secular than either Malaysia or Turkey. So on the question of whether you should, it's an essential feature of democracy that you tax the rich and subsidize the poor, from the left is not essential, so that's sort of the right, and the right is the left that is essential, but the scale increases from 1 to 10, so I didn't want to reverse the scale. So that if it's an essential, if democracy is supposed to be Robin Hood, then that's the right-hand side, and you can see Egypt is this humongous blue spike. So the extreme of the scale on the left is almost 60% of the population, compared to Turkey, which is the red, about half as many, and Malaysia, which is half of that. So on this measure of left to right, Egypt is much, much more left than Malaysia or Turkey. On the other measure of left to right, and there are way too many variables, so I'm only going to show you those two, but you know, there's a more elaborate story to be told, but then you have to show numbers in tables. Before I get to that, I wanted to just point out, it's not a matter of just class structure, okay? So everybody, including people who classify themselves as upper class, are saying that the government should be Robin Hood. So this one is Egypt only, broken down by identification of economic class. And that spike for the Robin Hood economy being the true democracy is true for all the classes. Of course, the poor are, you know, like that more than the rich, but the rich are still 50% saying, you know, people who are upper class are saying we want Robin Hood. Go figure. Okay, then on the religious dimension, on the anti-secularism dimension, remember, this is, so again, the extreme left here is that it's not at all essential that, that religious scholars interpret the law. The right hand is that it's absolutely essential. And so, again, nearly half of the Egyptians, and interestingly, I'm not showing it here, 28% of Christians, when you break it down by religion, are saying that it's an absolutely essential feature of democracy that religious scholars should be interpreting the law. So, and of course, you can see, so this level of anti-secularism, you know, is just dwarfs anything that you can see in Turkey or Malaysia. Turkey, of course, has a big secularist contingency that's at the other end. But just looking at this end, you know, Egypt is just much, much more. Now, there's an interesting question here, though, because in Turkey, you can have the usual one dimension. You're going to have people who are on the right economically and religious, and you can have people who are on the left politically and secular, right? So the question will be, are they the same or not? But I wanted to show you one more thing, and it's a good thing that Pakistan came up, because this is a different... So all of these have been from the 2005-2008 wave of the World Values Survey. To compare to Pakistan, I had to go back to the 2000-2001 wave to find the same question being asked in Egypt and Pakistan. It's close. This question is whether the state should only implement Sharia laws. No other laws, only Sharia laws. So it's some measure of anti-secularism. And they agree strongly, you can see, and then agree that Egypt, which is blue here, is so. Egyptians were thrilled when I presented this, that they are more anti-secular than Pakistan. They didn't recognize that, but they're very happy to find out. And again, it's not by class. So if I look only at Egypt and break it down by class about whether religious authorities should interpret the law, everybody, upper class, middle class, everybody wants religious scholars to interpret the law. The lowest actually is, if I break it down by profession, is in the military. But as we've just heard, the military may be transforming. Right? So it's not a class structure thing. Egypt has a very large contingency that's leftist, has a very large contingency that's anti-secular. The next question is, are these the same people? Or are there different groups, and you can sort of try to balance it? So then I have to show it in two dimensions. So this is Egypt alone. So here we have the scale for whether religious authorities should interpret the law or not. So all the way to the right here is going to be anti-secularism. Here is the measure of whether the government should be Robin Hood, tax the rich and subsidize the poor. All the way to the right is going to be left. And the biggest spike, I mean, and these are percentages. So percentages for every combination. And a good 40% of the population are at the extreme of the scale of anti-secularism and of leftism. They are leftist Islamist. We forget. People assume that all leftists are Nazareth, and we're, you know, because the university professors they meet or leftists are like that. But it precedes Nasser. Muhammad al-Ghazali, who was one of the fundamental theorists of the Muslim Brotherhood, his first two books in 1947, 1948 were about economics and were about socialism in economics. So, of course, what we have today is not your father's Muslim Brotherhood, but the Islamism that sort of started out in the aftermath of the decline of the dismantling of the Ottoman Empire was a leftist Islam. And some of this continued into Bakr al-Sadr and so on into the 70s. And then, of course, there was a clash between Nasserists and Islamists in the universities in the 70s after Nasser died. And people assumed that, okay, these are two completely opposite camps. Those were the active people, but the vast majority actually sympathized with both. They were leftist Islamists. Okay, so how is Egypt different? Unfortunately, there's that light bulb thing here, so you won't see the word. I know there's a way to make that light bulb vanish, because there are a bunch who look like that. Do you know how to?
Just click the arrow, I think. The little path.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, so if you compare Egypt to Malaysia, see, Malaysia, of course, is multi-ethnic. The Muslims are only about half the population, then you've got the Indians and the Chinese and so on. So Malaysia is, so now always think, you know, this is the leftist Islamist spike, right, in Egypt. And this is with the other measure of leftism, whether you want more public ownership or private ownership of enterprise. So there is a little bit more variation there, but the spike is still there, right? So on both of these, you look at Egypt and you compare it to Malaysia, Malaysia is much more centrist, right? So it's much easier to implement variations on the Washington Consensus in a country like Malaysia. Turkey, of course, as we all know, has a split personality. You know, the Islamists are not this, I mean, you've got the secularists and you know, they can't speak the same language as the Islamists, so you have spikes all over the place, you know, and they're all at the extremes. And some centrists, you know, emerging. And so it's still very, very different from Egypt. So Malaysia has a lot of people in the middle, so you can have sort of centrist policies working because that's where the majority is. Turkey has people on either side, so the center of gravity is still in the middle. Okay, so going forward, the Muslim Brotherhood's adoption of the Washington Consensus, I believe, will backfire economically because people will say, hey, you know, you want to remove subsidies to get $4.8 billion? Isn't that what Mubarak was doing, right? You know, maybe you recite the Quran better than Gamal, but it's the same thing. Pursuit of the Turkish or Malaysian models, again, they're anachronistic because Turkey and Malaysia started that 25 years ago in a completely different world. Trying to replicate that model now, even if you had countries that look like they looked then, would not work. In addition, these countries look nothing like Egypt. So just because, you know, there are people who are pious, who are at the helm. And about Erdogan, again, for Shibli, I mean, I don't know if you remember, when Erdogan came, he was hailed as, you know, it's like the Khalifa has come back, right? Mm-hmm. And then he gave a speech where he said, I'm a pious Muslim who's the head of a secular state. He sort of had to walk his way back to the airport because nobody would give him a ride. So he's reviled now by the Islamists because how could you use the word secular? I mean, in Egypt, you don't use the word secular, right? They use the word civil. So you say Madani. Madani is the antonym of askari, of military. But sort of everybody knows that this means secular. But nobody dares to say secular. If you say secular, you get kicked out. I was with a cabinet minister on a panel, and I used secular, and he kept using sectarian. His English is good enough. He knows the difference. But he just didn't want to use the word secular. Because if caught on camera saying secular, you're in trouble in Egyptian politics. Okay, so capitalism with Chinese characteristics, which is the hybrid that the Mubarak regime was really trying to do, you know, the industrial zones and so on. Well, that's exactly what Morsi is doing as well, going over there saying, come show us how to build industrial zones, you know, bring your investors and so on. Mix that with a little bit of the Washington consensus privatization and removal of subsidies, and everything would be dandy. Well, no. You'll produce growth for a while, but it'll be so unequal that it's going to backfire again. 1 minute. So success requires construction of a new social contract. Nobody's is working at this. Understand where the masses' preferences are. Maybe you can move these preferences over time, but it's going to take another generation. You know, this leftist Islamist, which nobody has recognized, was built basically from the 1950s until now. It's not going to be undone in 10 years. People were telling me, well, this was data up to 2008. Now that the Islamists have failed, you know, everything's going to change. No, you don't change your views about the world just because the government didn't do well. You say, I need the other Islamists. You know, they're going to do it right. So, and actually, the Washington consensus is bankrupt. And the new Washington consensus is bankrupt. It hasn't worked anywhere. The countries that try to implement these policies in Latin America anywhere else fail. Okay, it looks good on paper, but it has never worked. So, you know, the countries that succeed are the ones that sort of go a different way. We've been waiting for China to collapse now for quite a while, and they've been doing quite well, thank you, you know, 8 to 10% growth rates. So otherwise, the best that we can hope for is more muddling through, and it doesn't matter if it was more. I had some stuff on other countries and comparisons, but I'll stop here. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you. I'll invite the panelists to rejoin us. I'm sorry we went a little bit over time there with the different presentations, but I found that fascinating and certainly did not feel the urge to cut them any shorter than I did. I think what's come out, and I'll keep my comments fairly brief, in the case of Egypt, is just how the deterministic the political economy issues can potentially be. And I'm putting an open question to the panel about, you know, prospects over the next 12 months, given these formidable structural issues. Firstly, the military, which is clearly an important institution, but, you know, represents something like 25% of the economy, has cradle-to-grave benefits for all of its members, pension plans for transition from the military to political appointments, governorships, etc., to be CEOs of different enterprises. That's an incredible stake in the future of Egypt, but it's also something that's going to require a very delicate discussion if that institution is to share some of its benefits more widely and participate in a slightly reconfigured new Egypt. I'd just like to say very quickly, though, vis-a-vis your last point, Mahmoud, there's nothing wrong with muddling through. There's absolutely nothing wrong with muddling through.
And this
could well be what happens. And you know, okay, there may be an unrepresented leftist religiously inclined constituency in Egypt. But President Morsi, to echo Bob's point about running the economy through foreign policy, has focused on three things till now. One is a relationship with the World Bank and the IMF and freeing up $4.8 billion and doing whatever he has to do to keep that coming. He's cultivated his relationship with Saudi Arabia in the hope of additional loans and assistance. And, of course, he's worked assiduously with the United States and to keep up the assistance and the defence cooperation program, all three elements of which are essential to enable him to, you know, only defer an imminent financial crisis, which is measured in the months, not the years. And this leads me to another point vis-a-vis Morsi and the Muslim Brotherhood in general. Will the challenges of being in government, of directing national policy, will that have a moderating effect on the Muslim Brotherhood? And I think this is one of the key questions out of the Egypt example, is to what extent can the Muslim Brotherhood succeed as a political party and separate itself from the wider movement in general, and how will that play out? My final point, I think, and probably the greatest point of concern, though, and it comes from conversations with friends in Cairo and friends from the region who live in the US, is I can't overemphasize the excitement of January, February last year, where I was on Skype calls round the clock with Egyptian diplomats, Egyptian policymakers, Egyptian civil society about what was happening there in their country. I also can't overemphasize the anger feedback I'm getting from a range of constituencies in Egypt who are bitterly disappointed that they've got a transition process where, which they felt they helped create, they feel that they're largely absent from now. It's not just youth; it's right across the board, and it's partly related to this disaster of a transitional sequence, which has occurred. Which is not to say everything is bad. It's muddling through, and for that we should be grateful. But there's some, again, fairly serious structural challenges, and President Morsi will be earning his salary in the months and years ahead. Thank you. I think I'll just go straight to questions, actually, if you guys don't mind, and then let's, sure. let's and if you could introduce yourselves, we'll take three, and one, two, three.
Thank you very much. And
then we'll do the next round.
My name is Ruby Unger. Thank you so much for this panel. Your information and your experience are invaluable. I'd like to ask, because you're all here together and we're all here together, based on what has happened in the last 24 hours and is continuing to happen as we are here together today, I would really appreciate hearing from you. One, are you surprised at the events, the extent and ferocity of it? And secondly, who will intercede, and how will the destruction and death end?
This is in reaction to the
last 24 hours, 48
okay.
hours.
Thank
yeah.
you.
Thank
okay.
you.
Okay, take two more.
Yeah. Thank you, Steve Hansen, College, William & Mary. Panel was really fantastic. Thank you so much. I have two questions. One is just related to that last one, and it has to do more specifically with the resources in Muslim Brotherhood's interpretation of Islam to fend off certain kinds of extremist interpretations of the video. So Mercy apparently said today, the Prophet told us that an attack on a person is even worse than an attack on the Kaaba. Therefore, videotape obviously much lower than either of those. And that was in response possibly to Obama calling and threatening cut off of military aid. He has strategic reasons to try to fend things off. But is it enough culturally, especially in the context that Mahmoud described, to create a kind of fissure within Islamists about this tape, which seems to be pretty important? Second question is about Israel, which we haven't talked about, so I think it's important to bring it up. Is there a way that the relationship with Israel can maintain the status quo in all of this turmoil, particularly with threats on Iran that could become actual strikes? Of course, there's a Shia-Sunni split, so maybe that is a way that you could maintain a certain kind of equilibrium. But it strikes me it would be awfully difficult for Morsi or anybody else in Egypt to keep the peace treaty and keep the status quo if things really heat up. Thanks.
One more. And then we'll take Eva in the second round. Okay.
Daniel Lucia, Grinnell College. My question is for Bob, and this is about civilian-military relations and thinking about it in the broader context that we know once you've had a transition, a key element to sort of making that transition consolidate is keeping the guys with the guns out of power. And the various strategies that are used to that involve reducing the military budget, making sure the military budget is fully under civilian control, et cetera. And to me, Egypt provides this really interesting case, and I want your feedback on it, about how do we think about the Camp David Accords in this, when you have this enormous amount of money that's tied to a peace treaty that is designated precisely for military assistance. That's my question, sort of how does that fit into any of this?
Just on the events, obviously, you know, it's hard to predict these things, but I'm not surprised that this sort of reaction would take place. And on the one hand, you know, I can even predict to you now there will be more episodes like that, and sooner rather than later, because they work. I mean, the fact is, a criminal could put a tape like this, and he can upset the strategic priorities. So, if you imagine someone who really does have a political agenda wants to shift the strategic priorities, what would happen? So, the disturbing part of it is that as we are going through this revolutionary time in the Arab world, the fact that maybe a high school kid or a criminal can do something that alters the entire relationship and upsets the domestic coalitions and creates a crisis is very, very troubling. Now, how could this then be addressed? Because I don't think it's a question of policy by the U.S. or even individuals. I'm afraid that in that's why transitions are destabilizing. I mean, if I look back, part of the problem in the Arab world that preceded the revolution, and I think we've had it since the revolution, in large part because these revolutions were not led. I mean, we were talking about how the surprising part of the revolution is this happens, you know, grassroots. You don't have political parties. You don't have individuals. You don't have heroes. You don't have people who are the moral authority that people can go to. I want to hear from you. What is the right thing to do? There's no Nelson Mandela. There wasn't in the Arab world. That's why Arabs were embracing outsiders. They, of all the people they've embraced over the past decade, there was not a single sitting Arab ruler that people admired. And I think as we go through in Egypt, no one has that moral authority. Morsi himself, when you get, he barely, can you think in the runoff election, he barely beat Mubarak's ally in a revolutionary time, barely beat him when it was uncertain. So the fact is, there is no one with a Mandela-type moral authority to be able to say, you know, you can have interpretations, you can have voices. They make a difference. In the end, policies will matter. The Egyptian government probably didn't act aggressively enough. Initially went on the defensive, attacking the movie instead of also focused on attacking those people who were violent. I think that's likely to happen, and I worry about it. I mean, and this is really the shape of things to come. The second part of this I want to say about the U.S. Why the U.S.? I mean, this is a film. There was not a real story, you know, necessarily linked to the U.S. In fact, it was more about Israel initially. In the initial story was, we now know it's a different, you know, source, but at the time that was the story that spread out. And I think that, you know, this anger with America, which is sustained, which in all the polling that we've done, is really driven more than anything else by the wars, the presence of American forces, and the Palestine-Israel question. And that is, therefore, there's total mistrust of America. You can do all the right things for the right reasons, even. And people just simply not going to trust it because there's this, you know, over time, mistrust. In contrast, and I want to provide this contrast for coming to grips with it. In contrast, you take France with a colonial history, hated, the most hated, actually, of European powers early in the 20th century. And then after 1967, it cultivates a relationship with the Arabs, it certainly pulls out its forces, Algeria gets independence, it starts focus on the Palestine question. Its position starts improving in the Arab world after decades of trying. In right after the Iraq War, how many of you remember the crisis in France over the veil in French schools and over the immigrants who were mostly from Arab countries? And guess what happened in the Arab world? Nothing happened in the Arab world. And guess what the religious leader said, like Yusuf al-Qaradawi, the most influential Sunni cleric on Al Jazeera television, he was asked to condemn the French. He said, why should we condemn the French, condemn Bin Ali for that? And the French are supporting us, quote, supporting us on the Iraq War. They're supporting us on Palestine. It was nothing. So part of it is the anti-Americanism.
And don't underestimate that. It's not just this thing. Final point on the Israel issue. We have done polling on the Israel issue. Egyptians are really divided on this. We have a roughly 30-some percent say they want to end the treaty, and roughly just about a few percentage more say they want to keep the treaty, and somewhere in the middle they say they want to alter the treaty. My own view is that the treaty is in trouble. It's not just because of this, but there is a sense that Egyptians don't have sovereignty over the Sinai. We saw that in the recent episode, that they want to assert their sovereignty. And the Palestine question, in all of the polling over a decade, is more the prism of through which Egyptians see the world than almost any other Arab country. And so particularly if there's a flare-up and confrontation, bloodshed between Israel and the Palestinians, don't underestimate the push on whoever government, including a Morsi government, to change course.
I'll try not to go over the same ground and attack Peter, your question, the moderating effect, because I think it pulls together some of these other points. Will the exercise of power moderate the brothers? And what implications? All right, so who are the brothers? First question. And the answer is, I think the analogy, the organizational history of the brothers grew out of a combination of Sufi orders, Boy Scouts, and fascist parties. That was the organizational model. It was essentially a blend of the three. Therefore, a highly structured, very ideological organization. Finally, it's arrived in power. A party of that structure, of that ideological commitment, to just sort of say, well, suddenly let's pluralize and so on, I think it's not on. I don't think their first inclinations are to do that. They're to exercise power to achieve their objectives. So the question is, will they be able to achieve those objectives? And as we've heard from Mahmoud and others talking about the constraints on those objectives, it's unlikely they're going to be able to do so. There are plenty of forces allied against them. Their basic constituency really wants subsidies, and yet the driving force, the key man in the Brotherhood, Khayrat al-Shakhtar, is a business guy. And so there are lots of contradictions and difficulties here. So they are going to have two choices. They give in to all these constraints, and they say, well, we tried, but we'll be the majority in parliament. We'll, you know, contest. We'll divide power. And we'll get our way slowly, and we don't have to have it all in one bite. That's democracy, right? That's the transition. The other way is to go the radical way, to go in the old post-colonial state, not hopefully the post-post-colonial state, is to try to trump all of your enemies by outbidding them. Outbidding them in front of the embassy, outbidding them against Israel, outbidding them on the economy by handing out the whatever you've got, and so on. And so this is the key choice. And it's a little hard. I have, because we've been here, it's been hard to follow exactly what's going on, Morsi's statements and so on. But he clearly has tendencies in the outbidding direction. His trip was part of that. But he's going to run up against some very hard choices. If our guys were not at town in Washington, those choices would be put for him rather more urgently and rather more precisely than they have been to this point. Now, so what does this imply for the relationship with the military? Well, The 1979 peace treaty was based, and then the $1.3 billion going to the Egyptian military annually, was based on the assumption that the military would be downsized. And it was at that stage about 800,000 strong. It was assumed it would end up at about 250,000. It ended up at about 500,000, slightly less. And there it stayed. Now, how was it supported? Because the country, after all, doesn't have the amount of money necessary to support a 500,000 man army that costs, by their estimate, by their official figures, between 4 and 5 billion U.S. a year, by calculations on the basis of known expenditures, about 14 billion, right? Out of a total GDP of about 230 billion. So a hugely expensive undertaking. How do they do it? The military economy that Peter referred to. This grossly inefficient, this huge drag on national economic growth and so on, that's what they did. It's a net transfer of wealth from the country to the military. Now, if the brothers want to get out of the economic trap they're in. One of the ways of doing it is to dismantle that military economy and to downsize the military. Those two things would go together. If we take the military down to 250,000 and we use the $1.3 billion to truly modernize it as opposed to building tanks and airplanes that don't operate and are maintained by us, they are inoperable for the Egyptians, then you would have a useful military, you would have a better economy, you'd have a way out of the dilemma. But our the brothers, one, strong enough against the military, and two, would the military have officers who want to do this? They do have such officers. We know that. And the question, they have not been in positions of command. Could it be that Sisi and Morsi would come to this understanding that a downsized, more agile, lightweight, better trained, fully operationally capable independently of the United States be the way to go? To me, this is a happy scenario. And the military plays a very important role. Our military wants to do this, has wanted to do it since 1979, and was blocked by Mubarak and by our political considerations in the White House.
Very good. We've got the next round. Eva first, please. And then Munsef, and then Steve.
Thank you for a terrific panel.
Eva first takes, I'm sorry.
I wanted to follow up with another question about the military to Bob, and that is, I wonder if you can tell us a little bit more about the logic of the coup within the coup. How did how was Morsi able to harness the institutional interests of the military to get them to go along with jettisoning SCAF? And secondly, civilian oversight. Can you see civilian oversight of the military economic privileges? What's going to happen to that? But did they make any promises about that?
Yeah, again, Monsef. Thank you very, very much for those very rich analyses and data. One word is making difference between Egypt and Tunisia. It's Sharia. In Tunisia, we discussed this at length, and we decided that Sharia is only voted by parliamentaries in a parliament. So another voted internally and decided at 83% to support that idea. So we will not mention Sharia in the constitution. Sharia is what parliamentarians in Arabic, musharra, vote. And Tariq Ramadan, the Muslim thinker born in Switzerland from Egyptian descent, came to Tunis, made conferences, and explained to people, again, democracy is pedagogy, that in England, Sharia is what parliamentarians vote. So could we envisage this way of action in Egypt, getting rid of the problem by saying what really Sharia is, set of rules that were transcribed from sayings that are not completely true 12 centuries ago? Should we leave this to historians and vote present laws through parliamentarians? Thank you.
Yes, I want to join Monsef in thanking you guys for just a terrific panel. Both these panels this morning have been incredibly informative and rich theoretically as well as empirically. First of all, I just want to applaud Shibley's polls. The fact that you follow up a question, do you favor Sharia, with do you actually interpret Sharia as being something that should predominate in your heart as a Muslim, and that this is something that is a personal thing, or do you want to actually implement it in legal code in a literal fashion, and that you get 80% saying the former rather than the latter, is a tremendous contribution. Very often pollsters, of course, stop at the first question. Then Westerners are shocked when we find out that 80%, same thing in Indonesia, 80% of Indonesians also in good polling show that they're in favor of Sharia, and yet there's very little implementation of Sharia on the ground, and that's because people don't ask that follow-up question. In fact, many Egyptian Islamists, or let's say progressive Islamists, say that to actually implement Sharia in legal code would be to take it out of the heart. God is not going to give me credit for following his law if I actually am forced by secular authorities to do so. So I think this is a very important distinction to make, and I appreciate your doing it. And then I want to actually ask, just push back a little bit on some of the things Mahmoud said, because I think what the data you're presenting from the World Values Survey are really valuable, and they really do show that Egyptians are both less secular and further to the left than a lot of people elsewhere in the Islamic world. But I wonder how much that actually matters. I mean, you say that the Washington Consensus has failed. Some people might say, you know, some implementation of Washington Consensus policies in Latin America is what paved the way for 8% growth rates in Brazil over the Lula period. That some liberalization and privatization, actually destatization, was necessary. That the Chinese model has failed as well. But then, what can succeed? I mean, if the masses say they want socialism, does that mean socialism is going to work? Obviously, socialism doesn't tend to work. Subsidies don't tend to produce really high growth rates. And also, you know, I noticed from your slides that when it came to sympathy for the left, for, you know, using the incomes of the rich to subsidize the poor, the Turks are actually almost as far to the left as the Egyptians. Not on number 10. No, not on number 10. They're only, if you look at your leftism slide, not your secularism slide, where they're split, but the leftism, and you add up 8, 9, and 10 in Turkey, you get the same numbers as you get for Egypt. Okay? So it's true that Egyptians might be more likely to give it a 10. Yeah, absolutely. But Turks are also way, way skewed to the left. And when Erdogan's government can produce 8% of your growth rates year after year, as an Islamist, as a self-proclaimed Islamist, right, people have adjusted to that. And even though Turks continue, like Indonesians, to say, of course, we're social democrats, we're on the left, we want the rich to subsidize the poor, that hasn't interfered with the implementation of what you're calling Washington's consensus with safety nets. And it seems to work reasonably well.
Thank you. Well, we've got two there.
Yes. So let me start with the last question. I mean, in Turkey, of course, their success now is based on this interesting partnership, sort of two-way favoritism between Musiad and Erdogan, right? They made him mayor of Istanbul. He made them wealthy, and so in a way, it was getting the income distribution more equal. But when you're saying, why does it matter? It does matter because when people went out in the streets, they were saying, Aish, Hurriya, Adela, Ikhtimaiya, bread, freedom, social justice. It matters because it defines what social justice is, right? You go and tell them that equality is equality of opportunity, and that means absolutely nothing to them, right? The Joe Sixpack who wants to make sure millionaires aren't overtaxed because someday he might be a millionaire. That just doesn't exist over there. So you don't expect them to know that there's another model that would be successful. So what they do is they point to Malaysia, they point to Turkey, which are obviously not completely, you know, liberal economies. There's protectionism in Malaysia. You know, that's how they developed the car industry and so on. So they feel, well, this is sort of leftist and it's Islamist and it's worked, but, you know, we have to customize it a little bit. And that's what Khayyam Tishlati said. You know, I've gone to Malaysia and, you know, now I have the plan. Just put us in power and, you know, we'll take off. So they don't have to be coherent, right? But that's what they are. They think that they need a more egalitarian, in the sense of not equality of opportunity, but more equality of actual distribution. This is important. On the Sharia thing, I think people mix up the cards a lot. Sharia, the word, first of all, only occurs once in the Quran. Sharia is one of these words that is thrown around for political purposes by a variety of people, basically to say, you should listen to me, right? Because you should listen to God, and this is how you listen to God, is Sharia, and therefore you should listen to me because I will tell you what the Sharia is. But Sharia is like, you know, it's the Jewish halakha, right? It's the road to, you know, the road to salvation. It's not a code. It's not a less. That's fiqh. That's the implementation, and it changes with time and place and circumstance. This has been so documented in Islamic legal theory. It's, you know, every first year university student studying Islamic law knows that. So I take that out of the realm of religion, even at the realm of law and legislation, parliaments and all that. This is purely a political ploy. It's just like the word secular
cannot be used, the word Sharia should be used, but they're both meaningless terms because they're just being thrown around in order to win points with the masses who don't really understand. So I don't even want to get started on the Sharia stuff in the U.S., right? So.
If I may, I just want to, I mean, I had some thoughts less on the Sharia, but on this leftist Islam is still a little bit. And I mean, I wondered in some ways whether, you know, the results you have, particularly when it comes to comparing Malaysia, Turkey, and Egypt, whether it's just, you know, sort of Egyptians don't like what they have and the others like what they have. And this is all about, you know, kind of that sort of reaction, but this is really the legitimate comparison. I wonder if we might look at Latin, not necessarily Islamic countries, or maybe Latin America or something else. And you might possibly have a different breakdown. But to me, it's not surprising at all, actually, what you found. I mean, about Egypt, and I say that because I think what you call leftist is what I would see as social justice, which is something that even when Arab socialism embraced under Nasser, what they called ishtirakiya, was really social justice. It wasn't socialism. I mean, I don't know what socialism is. Nobody understood that. But it was really about social justice, which is why it resonated all along. Many of the activists within the Islamist groups, like Abu Ismail, the candidate for the presidency of the Salafi party, was quote, a leftist early on in his career.
Abdul Manan al-Fatuh,
and many of these guys. So in essence, they were driven by causes, and religion was kind of a vehicle to causes that preceded even the embrace of a particular vehicle. And so none of that is surprising. And we found some of it actually in some ways in the actual results of the election. I mean, what happened when, there was the parliamentary election. The Salafis did well, particularly in certain neighborhoods of Alexandria. Everybody assumed that those are going to go for Morsi in the presidential elections. Lo and behold, they were supporting the Arab secular candidate Salahi. So the fact that people are separating in their own minds between the religious vehicle and the causes that they're embracing is not particularly surprising. I think we don't do enough of that in sort of separating issues and aspirations from vehicles that people employ to get them.
Just one, last thought on that. The problem the brothers have is to service a new social contract, they have to have resources, and getting those resources is going to be very, very difficult indeed. So they could theoretically deal with these two different polar extremes and have a neoliberal economy that had a big social safety net. But where is the social safety net going to come from?
Where does ours come from? Yeah. Somebody prints money.
They'll print money.
QE4.
Yeah, that's right. But it's going to be tricky to balance those two things. Well, Eva asked me about how did the coup within the coup occurred, and what about civilian oversight of the military and the economy in particular? I won't go into the operational coup within the coup, but it's interesting if you take a look at it in detail. I've written a little bit about it, but it was well done in classic sort of coup stuff. That was a good. It was even better than Nasser's in a certain way. But why did it succeed? You know, at the structural level, first age. Tantawi 76, Sisi 57. Tantawi and his guys had hung around too long. And Egypt is a very ageist society. It respects age, but it also then respects retirement age. And Tantawi was way past it. So he was Mubarak. He was yesterday's papers. And it provided opportunities then for everybody below the age of 57 to get rapid promotions. So age was number one. Second, professionalization and all the resentments by younger officers of the lack of professionalism of Tantawi and his people, their corruption, the fact that the tanks sit in the crates and the planes sit on the tarmac and all the rest. So a lot of leadership feelings based on lack of profession and clear discrimination against the most professional officers, not being promoted, all sorts of stuff. The third
question, and this is a hypothesis. It's not known to me, but it's belief. Was there possibly a sense among the brothers and some of the people with CC that they were believers and that they would share the same cause, a commitment to Islamism? And there's some slight indications of that. I would think that's the least important of the variables, but I suspect it could have played some role. So those are the sort of structural conditions under which the coup occurred. Civilian oversight, and especially of the military economy. Sure, the press is full of it. Now a lot of young Egyptians are taking a look at this issue. It's being written upon. It's being discussed. But the pushback is really pretty profound, and to get this institutionalized is going to be really difficult, first in the Constitution, but then in parliamentary capacity. You know, to do this sort of oversight, as well as within the various branches, within the various departments, within the executive branch, that gather and analyze this sorts of information. This is not going to happen anytime soon. And the Defense and Security Affairs Committee of the Parliament has always been staffed by military, and it's again the chair under the brothers was until the parliament was prorogued, again from the military. So until you clear that out, and then last and most important, the Ministry of Defense. There is the only civilians in the Ministry of Defense are the coffee boys. That's it. So it is a holding company for the military. And so you are talking of major institutional changes here. And so while there are lots of voices and lots of articles and parties on record talking about the need for this sort of oversight, to translate that desire into reality, even in, you know, even if there's political will behind it of a major sort, it's going to take a long time.
Very good. Well, ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much. We've gone a little bit over time, 15 minutes into your lunch hour, I believe. But I think, as you all agree, it's been a fabulous panel, terrific presentations from three wise men. Please join me in congratulations.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.